The first time I saw one was I was invited by a friend of mine to a Cardiff to London race or rally or something like that. And I went there and I saw a red AM bicycle, which is sort of the bike he made in 83. And I just thought it looked like a vision of the future. This is really a corny reason to like it, but that's what sort of got me into it.
He's just a fountain of creativity, totally single-minded, and always living for the day and for tomorrow. He doesn't waste his time going back to the past, and that's really how the Molten came about, because he's got this ability to completely cut through and radicalise his thinking on design, and that's why he's the person who rethought the bike for the first time since the Bone Shaker.
A vision of the future, rethinking the bicycle for the first time since the Bone Shaker. You're listening to Resonance FM. I'm Jack Thurston, and for the next 2 weeks on The Bike Show, we're going to be telling the story of a man and his machines. A man who at 88 is still dreaming up the next evolution of his redesign of the bicycle, a design that took the 1960s by storm and opened up the door for a whole new generation of small-wheeled bicycles. It's a story of innovation and inspiration, but also a story of prejudice against the new and the perils of cutthroat commercial competition. We'll hear from the people who believe that riding a Molten means you're the member of a very special club. Today's top-of-the-range Moltons have a waiting list of a year and a half and cost as much as £7,000. But you can pick one of the 60s models up for less than 100 on the second-hand market. Whichever it is, they all share the same spirit and they all sprang from the determination of one man to build a better bicycle. Alex Molton was born in 1920 and spent World War II working for his family rubber business, specialising in vehicle suspension systems. In the 1950s, he was part of the team that developed the Mini, still ranked as the most popular British car ever made. At around the same time as working on the Mini, Alex Molton began thinking about bicycle design.
In 1956, in the Suez crisis of petrol rationing, I'd bought from a friend of mine a beautiful Hitchens, and I was so taken by how wonderful it was. I rode it. I was a mature person, 30, 35, whatever it was, and I hadn't been riding bicycles at all. I'd been on motorcycles and so on. I hadn't ridden a bicycle properly since undergraduate days when I would use some old gridiron. And I simply thought, what a fantastically wonderful experience, cycling on a lightweight a London bicycle. It was a classic design, the Hitchens. I started with that. And I said to myself, what do I like and what I don't like?
The first thing he wanted to get rid of was the top tube, or crossbar, the tube that runs from the handlebar to the saddle, and which has been a common feature of the bicycle since the 1880s.
You can't get onto it in a natural way by putting your leg through, number one. And number two, any form of getting off it in an excellent condition or any form of desire to get it off, you're trapped by the top tube. So that was the thing I thoroughly objected to.
He quickly realised that what he wanted was a one-size-fits-all step-through frame, but that this would require some serious thinking about wheel size.
I then considered why are the wheels the size they are? And remember that one had experience with Isigonis and the Mini, with whom I had the pleasure of working with as part of his team, the tremendous effect of the wheel size on the whole architecture of the vehicle. And I sensed at once that these, if one could only reduce the size of the wheel, then the whole architecture, a layout of the bicycle, would be enormously altered and improved.
The basic design of the bicycle had been unchanged for more than half a century. Maybe there was a reason for that. Maybe it had already achieved a platonic form, a state of perfection. What gave Alex Molton the belief he could tear up the rulebook and come up with something better?
I was extremely sensitive to that. I felt that perhaps the size of wheel, which I mentioned, 26, 28 inches, was fundamentally the minimum that is sensible to go to. And therefore, I was immensely sensitive to checking whether the ancients were correct. I was very sensitive to that. Therefore, I didn't presume to reduce the size without checking everything. And done up splendidly enabled me to make high-pressure tires of a smaller size with a high-class material. So at least, and then I established the basic fact, which I suppose was vaguely known, that the dominant factor of rolling resistance is not the wheel size, but the pressure.
For listeners with an aversion to physics, now is the time for the next minute or so to point your ears the other way.
The underlying physics is essentially what happens to the contact patch as it rolls around and makes contact with the ground. So it is the flexing of the walls as the cover comes around, and it is the energy loss in the flexing of it. So one can say that the lower the pressure, the more comfortable it is, and that when people on classical bicycles even use the word the suspension is in the tire. Well, of course, if you don't have a proper suspension, of course it is in the tire, and therefore the lower the pressure, the more comfortable it is, but the more the energy loss due to the flexing of the walls. So the pressure is predominant.
In other words, as the wheel rotates under the weight of the rider and the bicycle, the tires are repeatedly squashed and then expand back to their original shape. More energy is lost in the squashing of the tire than is gained when the tire rebounds to its original shape. And the greater the energy loss, the greater the drag. Alex Moulton's insight was that the way to reduce rolling resistance was to use tires with a very high pressure, tires that wouldn't squash so much while they were rolling along. But the advantage of small, high-pressure tires comes with a disadvantage in terms of rider comfort. Without some form of suspension, Moulton's new bicycle would be as uncomfortable as the solid-tired bone shakers of the previous century. I asked Dr. Moulton which came first, the idea of using small wheels or the idea of making a bike with full suspension.
The answer to the question is, a very good question, is both. In other words, remember that I come from a rubber background. In fact, my great-grandfather introduced the vulcanized rubber into this country in the 1840s, from the extraordinary brilliant invention of Charles Goodyear in New York State in the 1830s. And so my background, family background, it was rubber, and therefore that led me into doing a whole series of new car suspensions, and which one was it on the Mini, and therefore it was natural, any vehicle carrying a human being, I thought, should have suspension. So from that point of view, yes, for that. And also, of course, I knew with a high pressure tire on the small wheel, it would be mandatory. So from both reasons, it had to have suspension.
Convinced that small wheels with high pressure and suspension were the way forward, Moulton then looked at how to make the frame. His first prototype was based on an aircraft fuselage known as a monocoque or single shell structure.
I rode that in the first case and was horrified by the noise from the resonance. Here we are. Here's the monocoque. Let me tap it. You can hear the noise going on. 5.5 pounds only, so very light, but it was unacceptable road noise. I mean, one of the enormous charms of the bicycle is its silence. So I decided in no way I was going to have a monocoque. So how do you get the stiffness from the classical bicycle with a steel tube by an open frame? So the essential feature was a big tube, a one-piece tube. It was a flat-sided oval of about 2.25 inches diameter.
He knew pretty well that he was onto something.
I had no intention of making the bicycle myself, so I offered it to the world's largest, at that time, I think, and certainly the most senior bicycle manufacturer in the world, namely Raleigh. And the chairman of Raleigh, I'd asked him to come down. We'd just done the patent on it. And I asked him to come down to have a look at it here at Bradford. And he came down in his Mark 10 Jaguar with a sort of light roadster to compare it with. And he said that it was the most interesting thing that he'd seen in his professional career.
Even so, it was perhaps too radical for Raleigh. And in the end, they passed on the idea. Moulton decided that he would have to go it alone.
rather motivated by and encouraged by the dynamism, the 1960s dynamism of the motor industry, which led to the Mini and so on, to do it myself. And but before doing so, I thought, well, am I mad? Because as Rally, with their great experience, had said is unmarketable, I did a little market survey away from anywhere where I might have been known, up in the north, and in a bicycle shop, in which I had two immaculate prototypes in this shop. And the public coming into the bicycle shop were asked, "Would they are they interested in this extraordinary thing?" And at a price, the price then was only about 20% more than the mass-produced light roadster. I think it was about £32 instead of about £28 sterling. And 60% of the people came in, said they would buy it. So I knew that I was right. And I knew that the conventional attitude was wrong. And that was confirmed at the bicycle show in 1962 at Earl's Court, where we were absolutely overwhelmed by orders.
Tony Hadland, author of two histories of Moulton bicycles, remembers the first time he laid eyes on one.
I was, I suppose, about 14 when it first came out. And my first sight of it was, in fact, when the wife of the local bike shop went to the bakery across the road. I used to sit there as a sort of gormless teenager looking out the window. Mrs. Buttrew turned up on this extraordinary bike and parked it outside the baker's. And I thought, what on earth is that?
That was a low-slung bike with a single large horizontal tube, tiny 16-inch diameter wheels, and a miniaturised rubber suspension. Moulton was all too aware of the potential for a hostile reception to his novel creation and was keen to demonstrate its superiority in pure speed as well as in comfort and ease of use.
We were trying to demonstrate its superiority by having on the show stand an actual record-breaking bicycle. But the weather wasn't good for that, but we did, it a month later, demonstrate with a standard bicycle. The Cardiff to London record was broken by 18 minutes, averaging 24 miles an hour, which was an extraordinary performance. And it was noticed then, for the first time, that the in freewheeling down the steep hills in the Chilterns, the bicycle was achieving over 50 miles an hour, which showed, if you like, the fundamental advantage of our design.
The bike shop there had this big display about a guy called John Woodburn, who had broken the Cardiff London record on one of these Moultons. I thought, well, this is not just a gimmick. There's obviously something here that works.
Impressing a 14-year-old teenager looking into a Reading shop window was one thing, but the new bicycle also impressed Tom Simpson, Britain's top bike racer, who is pictured riding a Moulton at a track meet at the Herne Hill Velodrome.
And he said to me, I'd ride there in the next Tour de France if I wasn't tied up to Peugeot. That was, of course, before the UCI had been so rigorous, but he thought it was outstanding.
As well as impressing on the track and in long road races, the Moulton was picking up followers who loved the way it looked. Michael Wolfe, founder of Moulton Preservation, explains.
What we have here is the Lazy F frame, which sweeps all the way through the frame and continues down on the rear fork, the pivoting rear fork there. But the interesting thing about the aesthetic was that when it first came out, the tubes were so long, the head tube and the seat tube being so long, that it actually did this billiard cue effect. So the tops of the tubes being white and the lower parts of the tubes being a dark colour gave it this rather lower, lean appearance, which I think is very attractive, but it was to shorten the look. So you've got this beautiful sweeping thing and almost like a liner with two funnels, as the Queen Elizabeth would have had at the time. And I think that's really what gives it this lovely look. But I think he did have an eye for the aesthetic, which later on he didn't have to compromise with the AMs, the space frame bikes. He just went for the nitty-gritty efficiency thing. Which does have its charm, because I think beauty is inherent in anything which is totally functional. But it's not the same sort of beauty. This is almost like an inception of an idea, a dreamlike quality. And it was perfect in the 60s with all the mini things. Mary Quant, mini skirt. You can almost hear the Beatles in them in a certain way.
One, two, three, four! Yeah.
I think everything was becoming slightly more rounded and optimistic. The angular thing was becoming much more rounded and approachable. A sense of optimism and a sense of joy and the style of the time. And so it was ahead, and it spoke to people who wanted to go forward with that optimism.
Coming out of the bleak period of the 1950s, when we'd had, you know, sweet rationing, which is a bad thing for a child to grow up with, and things were very dull, you know, diet had been dull, and life in general was rather dull in the 50s. And then the 60s, of course, everything started taking off, as is well known. And there was the famous phrase about the white-hot technological revolution that Harold Wilson came out with, and there were all these new things. You know, there was a sort of a belief that everything was going to get better in every way. Hovercrafts, jet engines, all sorts of things were coming through, and the Moulton bicycle came through at the same sort of time.
There was a dynamism in the creative world at that time. I think it was being restricted during the war, which we were very conscious of having won the war, and so we felt that we were able to make things. I'm talking about weapons of war, if you like, which were not inferior to our enemies. So we had a confidence in the manufacturing, engineering world that we could do things. And so having got out of the restrictions, some post-war restriction, we burgeoned forth with things which are pent up, if you like. And so that's from my engineering point of view, and the dynamism, very much the dynamism of Birmingham, the Midlands, which had enjoyed the experience of making aero engines under license and so on. So there was a certain dynamism there in Birmingham particularly. From a design point of view, there was the design council being formed, and there was the Britain Committee exhibition. All these things were expressing the pent-up dynamism of being released. I think I can only say that.
The use of Moulton bicycles in racing was causing quite a stir, and it was not without its detractors.
In a bunch of conventional bicycles, the presence of something unusual rattling about in the bunch is unattractive to the other users. Also, that with our small-wheel bicycle, we could get a better drafting to the large wheel than vice versa. So that was a disadvantage to them. But we did some remarkable racing in the early 60s at the in Coventry, in a pursuit race, we broke the record and outstripped a conventional racing bicycle.
It was always going to be difficult for the Moulton to gain acceptance in the bike racing world. The reasons are a little contradictory. On the one hand, there was real prejudice against this impudent small-wheeled newcomer. How could a bike like this possibly be faster? At the same time, the governing bodies of the sport were clamping down on unconventional designs that were thought to give riders an advantage.
The rider, if he won on the bicycle, it was due to his superiority, he felt. If he lost, it was due to the bicycle itself. So there was an argument of having a common instrument. And that certainly was, of course, the UCI now, are extremely rigorous in the control of the form of the bicycle. That's locked it up.
Does it pain you that it's unlikely that a bicycle of your design will ever compete in the Tour de France or the Giro d'Italia?
Doesn't upset me at all. I know mine's superior. I simply ride it.
So much for the early history. I thought it was high time I had a ride on a Moulton myself. So I asked Tony Hadland to take me out on a quick spin.
Well, we're rolling along in the Vale of White Horse here in Oxfordshire. And I'm happy to say that I'm enjoying the ride. It's slightly difficult to feel the effect of the suspension, but we're going over a little bit of agricultural detritus in the road, and I'm not feeling it as much as I did when I rode up on my conventional sized touring bike. It's a great ride. Do you think that the ride's a little more jerky? The front wheel has a little bit more kind of responsiveness, which can be a bit tricky.
I think that's one of the things that people first notice if they've come from a background of riding conventional bikes, 700cc or 26-inch wheel, that sort of thing. Light steering is the thing that they'll notice first. and that can seem a little bit off-putting. When you get used to it, or if you've come from the opposite direction where you've done most of your riding on a Moulton, when you go back to a conventional bike, it actually feels very wooden and difficult to manoeuvre around things.
While we were riding along, Tony recounted how, having saved up enough money from his paper round to actually buy a Moulton, he set off with some friends the very day after England's victory in the 1966 Football World Cup.
In those days, of course, there was a tenth the number of cars on the road, and we just went straight up the A4 from Reading, straight through the centre of London, saw Bobby Moore driving around London the day after he'd captained the England team to victory, and cycled out of London on the A2 down to Dover, and that was about 125 miles, and then we were so excited, we stayed up all night on the ferry to Ostend chatting to kids from Belgium and France and Luxembourg. Never met such people before, you know, listening to pirate radio stations. 6 o'clock in the morning, got turfed off the ferry into Ostend, completely new territory, and we cycled all day through Belgium, arriving in Brussels at about 7 o'clock in the evening, by which time we'd done 200 miles in 36 hours, and that was the start of a couple of weeks touring around the continent, which was a real eye-opener for a 17-year-old kid.
Around 150,000 of the original F-frame Moultons were sold during the 1960s, and as Michael Wolfe explains, the design became something of a victim of its own success.
During the production of the early F-frame, it took off so much that Alex actually built a bigger factory within the grounds of the hall. That wasn't sufficient, but because of his relationship with BMC, British Leyland, it became, they were producing the Mini, which of course he had a major design interest in the suspension. So they used a factory to produce the F-frame at Kirby in Liverpool. And the lads there were actually supposed to be building Minis and built these things with great hatred, because building a push bike in the 60s wasn't really cool. They weren't built to the right standard. The brazing and things like that was atrocious. And they became a victim of their success because they were being knocked out in this huge and rather unskilled manner.
As well as the problems of manufacturing on a large scale, there was the problem of imitation by inferior copycat designs and a whole flood of new small-wheeler bicycles that weren't anywhere near as good as the Moulton.
Most people just think it's a bike that Granny rides down to the shops, because the whole sort of shopper thing, where people imitated the Moulton in a sort of degraded way, and you had all these shopper bikes, which were great for shopping, but not much else, and people thought the Moulton was just the same kind of thing.
Ultimately, Raleigh, who had turned down the original Moulton patent, proved to be too powerful as a commercial rival.
We became in conflict with Raleigh in the late 60s, who responded to the fact that they hadn't taken up the Moulton bicycle with something in the manner of, namely, RSW 16. And so we were in a disadvantageous position commercially, and I sold out a distress sale to Raleigh, and that was out of the game for some time.
And how did that make you feel when you had to sell out?
Oh, sad, I suppose. Yes, sad. But these things, one has to face up, if you like, to commercial situations.
Skip forward a decade or so, and Michael Wolfe, who as a child had learned to ride a bicycle borrowing a friend's Moulton, was now looking for a bike of his own for getting around in London.
And I looked everywhere for a Moulton, and everyone by that time was saying, you know, buy a Raleigh, buy something nice and shiny and cheap. But it was just, there were cheap copies by then. The Moulton was off production, having been bought by Raleigh and scrapped some years later. So I really wanted to find one. And eventually I found an old schoolmaster living across the road here who had a very tatty one, which I used to borrow for rides occasionally. And I absolutely fell in love with it, despite the fact that the bearings were gone, the steering was dodgy, suspension wasn't working and the gears didn't work. So I went to some shops and they said, oh no, you want to get rid of that, it's dangerous, it's rubbish. And that incensed me, because the basic thing was that they said the thing was different. It's different, you want to get rid of that, it's different. And having sort of lived through school being different and realising this was actually a good thing to be, not a bad thing, I was going to suffer for being different, and the Moulton went the same way. So at that stage, I decided that something had to be done with Miranda, as we always knew her, and this is the one here, because she's something special. And everywhere I went, they said no, except Mender Bike. Now, Mender Bike still exists. They're over in Fulham somewhere. And Pete at Mendebike said, look, if you can get us the bearings, we'll do the job. And we started musing, there must be a Mr. Moulton somewhere in the world. And so eventually, through Raleigh, wrote a letter. And a few weeks later, I found this little parcel in the post with nylon bushings and things like that. And they said, use what you need, but please send back what you don't, because we haven't got it anymore. Things are getting scarce. So we restored Miranda here. And my partner at the time, Helen Marsland, did a great job with me and got it on the road, sent a picture to the Moulton people. And they said, oh, do bring it down. And we've never seen one fully restored. Let's do it. So we went down about 1979. They were very impressed with this. And I said, well, could we join the preservation group? And they said, no such thing. I was most distressed by this. I thought, this is far too special. So I said, could we start one? And they said, yes.
We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save Donald Duck, Bonneville and Variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save Strawberry Jam and all the different varieties. Preserving the old ways from being abused. Protecting the new ways for me and for you.
So we began by sticking little innocent labels on people's Moultons around London.
Were there many Moultons on the streets of London at that time?
Yes, in those days there were still quite a lot, all sorts of people riding them across the board, right from Quentin Hogg, the Chancellor, at the time, some years before that, he was always seen on one. Various people right through the echelons of society, really, to people just doing their shopping on them. Anyway, so yes, there were plenty around, and we used to stick these labels on. And then one day, a chance meeting, my partner Helen met with Mark Ottaway. He was on a Moulton, she was on a Moulton, she brought him back to tea. I had no idea who he was, and then he said, I think we've got a story here. And he was the travel editor on the Sunday Times. And so he did a story, he went to see Alex Moulton, and it ran on the 30th of March, 1980. And he said, you might get a few letters. And in the first week, we got 50 letters and a dozen bicycles on the doorstep. And from then on, it's just gone from strength to strength.
Well, this is one of the things that staggered me, because my first knowing of the Moulton was simply as a consumer. You know, I bought a Moulton as a schoolboy, and then time went by, and I, as a married man with a young family, I got interested in them again. And at that stage, they were out of production. Very few people were interested. And I discovered to my amazement that there was actually a fan club, as you might call it, which had about 100 members, in total.
And that could have been the end of the story. A brilliant innovation eventually killed off by an inferior rival backed by a more powerful commercial competitor. A star that for a few years burned brightly before fading into obscurity. An evolutionary dead end. At the end of the 60s, Alex Moulton could have called it a day. But instead, he decided that, just like a bicycle, the only way to go was forward. And during the 1970s, he kept on thinking about how to refine his concept, hoping one day to return to the fray.
Going back again, I wanted to make something different to what I'd originally done. I introduced the Y-frame, which has now been very widely copied. In the late 70s, or mid-70s, I was riding with a friend of mine who had a Moulton bicycle, Frenchman, in France, and he said, I must show this new bicycle to my friend, who was a racing cyclist. And I showed it to him, and this Frenchman said, oh, it's far too heavy. So I was very spurred by this, and came back and said to myself, how can I radically reduce the weight? And I innovated this thing of a space frame, which, of course, I mean, if you look at the space vehicles and so on, they're all made in a triangulated space form, which really has been the basis of my design ever since. It's a stiffer, lighter structure than is possible with a single tube. It is stiffness and lightness.
Thus was born the extraordinary Moulton space frame bicycle. Sir Norman Foster, the British architect, referred to its sparse beauty when nominating it as the greatest work of 20th century British design. Its gossamer thin skeletal lines embody a purity and economy, the bicycle as architecture on wheels. If the F-frame was a happy-go-lucky child of the 60s, its striking modernity tempered by fun, the space frame is an altogether more serious design, putting function firmly above form, moving uncompromisingly into the future. One step through for man, one giant leap for bike kind.
Tune into the bike show here on Resonance FM at the same time next week when we'll pick up the story from here.